This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww. Jonathan, wake up! Happy New Year!
What happened?
That fifth Jaeger bomb really did you in last night.
That's the last time I let you convince me to go to a New Year's Eve party.
Not to worry, I took a video of you dancing on the table so we can record it for posterity. See?
And you felt the need to save that?
Don't worry, I deleted the one where you weren't wearing any pants. Come on, let's get some coffee inside of you.
Everything hurts.
Yeah, I wonder how Dan and James are doing.
No, I meant not the podcast. Never mind. Do I need to get checked for osteoporosis? I feel like every bone in my body is aching.
So, interestingly enough, osteoporosis isn't actually painful.
That is interesting, because...
That's right. Let it all out. Purge your body of the evil humors.
Show about medicine.
Proven to lower your blood pressure.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're gonna look at the evidence behind medical topics, and the show is...
Wait. No, I wanna say it.
I wanna say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of evidence. It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
Welcome back, podcast listeners. We are off to a running start in 2023. COVID is now firmly behind us, and like the many people who have predicted the end of COVID multiple times, I will in no way acknowledge any suggestion to the contrary.
But you know, the situation in China is actually...
La, I'm not listening, la. Some things are just too difficult for the human mind to process, so I'm ignoring it entirely and suppressing anything I don't want to deal with.
Well, that is a popular strategy these days.
It's basically public health at this point. That voice of conditional pessimism is that of my co-host, Dr. Christopher Labos, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and man who, for some reason, really does believe this is going to be the year we get our own TV show.
I feel like 2023 is going to be the year of the Labos.
And the Jerry.
Well, sure, by extension, I guess. And that is my co-host, Jonathan Jarry, podcaster, science communicator, and man who doesn't realize success is just one viral video away.
I told you I will not go skydiving without a parachute just to prove a point about evidence-based medicine.
Suit yourself, but you know, there have been reports of people surviving freefall from a plane without their parachute opening.
Anecdotes are a weak form of evidence. Plus, I have no desire to break every bone in my body, which is directly relevant to our topic for today, which is osteoporosis, the other way to break every bone in your body.
So actually, with osteoporosis, you're more likely to break some bones more than others.
Well, okay, so let's begin with the obvious question of what osteoporosis is.
It is a decrease in bone mineral density, which makes bones more fragile and more prone to breaking.
So it's really just as simple as that, like the bone mineral density you measure when you go for testing?
Well, there's a lot of different factors that play into it. It's not just about bone mineral density, or BMD, as you sometimes see it written. The architecture of the bone is also affected, and also the different cells involved in bone turnover play a role. But the actual definition of osteoporosis is actually based on your bone mineral density. That's how we measure it, and that's how we diagnose it.
So what are these different cells that you're talking about?
So there's actually a lot of different types of bone cells. Most people think bone is just solid tissue, like it's a sheet or a rod of calcium that is solid and unchanging. But actually, there's different types of cells in your bone, and your bone is constantly being broken down and built back up. The cells that break down bone or resorb bone, to use the accurate term, are called osteoclasts, whereas the cells that build up bone are called osteoblasts. Another type of bone cell called osteocytes is what makes up most of your bone mass.
Makes sense, because I mean, if bone was inert tissue, like you said, like a rod of calcium, then a broken bone could never heal.
Exactly.
So the obvious inference here is that you can develop bone problems like osteoporosis if your osteoblasts underperform, or if your osteoclasts are overly active, or even, I'm guessing, some combination of the two.
Exactly. Now, there's actually a third possibility. You can get low bone density because of decreased peak bone mass.
So meaning you never build up your bones properly in childhood?
In effect, yes.
I'm guessing that comes from childhood illnesses?
Yeah, or nutritional deficiencies, malnutrition, some endocrine diseases, stuff like that.
And I'm also guessing that's not very common in the global north.
No, not so much. I mean, for us, when we talk about osteoporosis, it's usually age-related and a problem of increased bone resorption, i.e. too much osteoclast activity.
And how do we test for this?
Well, we can use things called bone turnover markers. So you can measure things like C-telopeptide, which measures osteoclast activity, or things like osteocalcin or N-terminal propeptide of type 1 procollagen, often called PINP, P-I-N-P, which measures bone formation. But the reality is they're not that useful. There's a lot of variability between labs. There's a lack of standardization, and we see random fluctuations even in repeated samples from the same patient.
Couldn't we just suck less and use better tests?
Well, sucking less is hard for humans to do.
That is fair.
Yeah. But even so, it's not clear how useful these tests would be for most people. They are interesting in the sense that you give you a better idea of what's going on and what's causing the bone loss. They may be useful in very specific situations or atypical cases. And I have seen some specialists use them to monitor response to therapy. But in general, it's not clear how they would be useful, you know, for the diagnostic workup of most people.
So these tests look cool superficially, and they're maybe kind of interesting, but ultimately useless. Just like you.
Oh, wow. We're starting off mean this year.
But to be fair, we never stopped. So basically, most cases of osteoporosis are age-related.
Yes. Well, age and estrogen. The loss of estrogen after menopause in women really increases the risk of osteoporosis by increasing bone resorption.
So why doesn't hormone replacement therapy work then?
Who says it doesn't?
You did several times in past episodes. You won't shut up about it.
Ah, so hormone replacement therapy, or HRT, as a cardiovascular or cancer prevention strategy doesn't work. That's what we found with the Women's Health Initiative study, or the WHI study. But even the WHI study found that estrogen decreases the risk of osteoporosis and fractures. It's just that alternative treatments for osteoporosis exist, and you can use those and avoid the issues of blood clots and all the other stuff that come with hormone therapy.
Ah, okay. So after the break, we'll talk about some of those osteoporosis treatments and see what works and what doesn't. That's after the break. Step into our audio-only time machine and revisit past episodes of the podcast. Here is a clip from episode 42 on childbirth.
Yes, and you can go back as far as the 19th century when Queen Victoria wanted to use chloroform during childbirth. Some people objected that it was unnatural or that it violated biblical scripture because Eve had to endure the pains of childbirth after eating from the tree of knowledge.
What was the Queen's response? Was she amused? All of our episodes are available at bodyofevidence.ca and wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the show. Welcome back, podcast listeners. Today we are talking about osteoporosis, which is really important because most people don't understand how debilitating a hip fracture can actually be.
Yeah, I mean, it's major surgery and the recovery and rehab can be really long.
So before the break, we were talking about some of the biology surrounding osteoporosis. And while you can measure all kinds of biomarkers to look at specifically like cellular activity and like changes in how certain cells in the bones work over time, in most cases, you know, those tests are not great. It boils down to really what you want to do is you want to measure bone density, right? And while there's a few different ways to do that, the most common way is DEXA, or dual energy X-ray absorptiometry. Now, without getting too deep into the physics of it, you basically use x-rays at two different energy levels to measure how much of the energy is being absorbed by your bones compared to the soft tissue surrounding them. And the amount of energy absorption correlates with the density of your bones, right?
Right. And now, an important point here is that you actually measure bone density in two places, the hip and the spine. And you take the lower score out of the two to make the diagnosis of osteoporosis.
So this is the so-called T-score, right? That's the final number you get when you do a bone density test, right?
Exactly. You get one T-score for the spine and one for the hip, and you take the lower of the two.
And so what exactly is a T-score?
So the answer is a bit mathematical.
Pass.
No, this is really interesting.
I doubt it. You're the only one I know who told me that Mitchell and Webb's number wangs kits actually made sense.
Trust me, the T-score is about standard deviation, so you take a healthy control group and then you compare them to a unhealthy group. Standard deviations away from the mean, and that's how you make the diagnosis.
Sorry, what? Oh, good. You're done. Good, okay.
Right, so that's really it. Your T-score is how well you compare to a healthy young woman's bone density. A score of minus 2.5 means you're 2.5 standard deviations below the mean of a healthy control group.
Is there no clinical diagnosis for osteoporosis? Like, you know, no specific symptom to look out for or physical exam findings? Like, you know, you palpate someone's femur and you go, it's a bit spongy.
No, I mean, there's no symptoms for osteoporosis until you break a bone. You can't feel it unless you test for it. There's also nothing on physical exam.
Until you break a bone.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in school, they would teach us all these historical physical exam findings, like have a patient stand against the wall and see if their head stoops forward more than 5 centimeters from the wall or some random BS like that. And then, you know, measure the distance between their ribs and their pelvis or something. I can't remember. None of it actually works.
So why were these things taught?
Because, well, when you have osteoporosis and get vertebral fractures, because of the way the vertebrae actually break, the front basically collapses. And the vertebrae go from discs to wedges. And just the consequences of that is that your spine curves and you stoop more and you get a hump in your upper back that makes you bend over stooping.
That's from osteoporosis? I thought that was scoliosis or lordosis or kyphosis.
Well, I mean, some of it might be, but a lot of it, especially in older women, is osteoporosis from multiple and chronic vertebral fractures. It leads to that stooped posture and the curvature of the spine that used to be called a dowager's hump.
And they don't call it that anymore, I imagine, / hope. And for our younger listeners who might be unfamiliar with the word, dowager refers to a widow with a title derived from her late husband, or more informally, to a dignified elderly woman.
All fans of Downton Abbey will be familiar with that term.
I've never watched that show.
You are missing out, my friend.
I don't think I am.
Yes, you are. So here's the thing. I mean, fortunately, we don't really use that term anymore because it is somewhat archaic and outdated. And medicine, especially medical nomenclature, has become about 10% less stupid in recent years. But the problem with using that as a physical exam finding is that a patient needs to have multiple compression fractures of the spine for anybody to be able to notice the curvature. So this is useful to diagnose late stage disease, but it's not very helpful early on when you can actually make a difference.
Okay, so to recap, you diagnose osteoporosis either by witnessing low bone density on a specific test that uses x-rays, or you diagnose it because your patient has a broken bone, right?
Yes, but not just any broken bone. There are what we call fragility fractures. So it has to be a fracture of the hip, spine, wrist, humerus, rib, or pelvis due to a fall from your own height or less.
Right, so something that wouldn't typically cause a broken bone if your bones were otherwise healthy.
Right. Yes. So breaking a bone because you were in a car accident or fell downstairs or fell, you know, multiple stories, that wouldn't count as a typical osteoporotic fracture. But if you had a typical hip fracture, then technically you wouldn't need to measure bone density to make the diagnosis, although practically speaking, most people probably would just for documentation purposes.
Okay, and the bone density has to be a score of minus 2.5 or less to or more, I'm guessing, right, to make the diagnosis.
Right, so a score of minus 1 to minus 2.5 is technically osteopenia rather than full osteoporosis. Osteopenia is a reduced bone mass that is not as severe as osteoporosis. And any score from 0 to minus 1 is considered normal. Zero essentially means that you have the same bone density as a healthy young woman. That's the control population. And if you had a positive score, it would mean that you had higher bone density than a healthy normal population, although we don't often see that for obvious reasons.
Unless you test Wonder Woman.
Exactly.
I know you've said it earlier, but I'm curious to know why you don't compare a patient's score to someone their own age instead.
Well, so that would be what we call the Z score, and some reports still calculate and report it. But the actual diagnosis of osteoporosis is made with the T score, you know, so compared to a healthy young woman.
Is there any value then in using the Z score or Z score, depending on where you're from, where you are compared to someone your own age?
So maybe. Now, in theory, you could use it in specific situations when you're trying to figure out what's the cause of the osteoporosis. So imagine you had a low T score below minus 2.5. So you know you have low bone density, but then you might want to look at the Z score or Z score to see how you compare to people your own age.
And this might give you an indication if the osteoporosis is consistent with age-related bone loss or if there's some underlying problem going on?
Yes, although, you know, in practical terms, just by reviewing a patient's medical record and doing some fairly basic routine tests, you can usually figure out if the osteoporosis is being caused by something else.
Something other than aging. And so the most common things would be what?
Well, like kidney disease.
Really?
Yeah.
If you don't know much about human biology, that sounds really surprising and unconnected.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. When your kidneys fail, you lose the ability to activate vitamin D. So you become vitamin D deficient because there's an enzyme in your kidneys that is necessary to activate vitamin D. So people who are in kidney failure are actually vitamin D deficient, and that in turn leads to an increase in parathyroid hormone, PTH, which can lead to bone loss. Now, another thing that can often cause osteoporosis is cancer. And I mean, there's less common stuff like primary bone diseases like Paget's and osteomalacia. And then there are some medications that can cause premature osteoporosis, the biggest one being steroids.
Steroids are a big risk factor for osteoporosis? Oh.
Yeah, now, I mean, actually to the point where someone who's taking steroids long-term is usually treated for osteoporosis prophylactically, meaning as a preventative, just to minimize the risk. See, the thing is that steroids don't just upregulate the osteoclasts and cause more bone resorption. They actually also suppress the osteoblasts. So they're having a negative effect in two different ways.
I'm guessing you would suspect some underlying problem if someone got osteoporosis at a young age or simply younger than average, right?
Right. I mean, the unfortunate reality is that osteoporosis is usually age-related and more common in women after menopause. If you see osteoporosis in a premenopausal woman or in a man, then you should start asking yourself if something else is going on. That is a common question on board exams, actually, for any medical students out there who might be listening. You know, a young man has osteoporosis and you're supposed to realize it's because he has vitamin D deficiency from celiac disease or whatever. I mean, it doesn't happen commonly, but you need to be aware of these exceptions.
Okay, so assuming your osteoporosis is not due to celiac disease or to renal failure or to the use of steroids, what do you do when you have osteoporosis?
You treat it.
Pills, right?
Our Michelle. Well, first, you have to start with the risk factor stuff. So get people to stop smoking and cut back on alcohol.
I feel like that's true no matter what disease we're talking about.
That is fair. Also, exercise is good for you.
I'll go call the Nobel Prize Committee. Hey, Sweden, Dr. Christopher Lavos has discovered something amazing. Exercise is good for you. Any particular type of exercise, future Nobel Prize nominee?
Well, typically weight-bearing exercise, basically so that your bones are supporting your weight. That's what has the most benefit. But practically, any form of exercise is beneficial, and the studies have shown that even things like light walks confer a benefit. And even exercise that strengthen the core and help with balance will be beneficial. Even though they may not increase bone density, if they reduce the risk of falls, they reduce fractures.
You don't typically hear about septa and octogenarians talking about strengthening their core, but maybe they should. I think that bro science may have overlooked a key demographic. I want to see an octogenarian shredded. Mm-hmm. I'm here for that.
Yeah, me too.
Now, what about supplements like calcium, like vitamin D? I know you never pass up an opportunity to take a massive smelly dump all over vitamin D supplementation.
Right. Now, so the thing about the vitamin D research is that when you look at the statistics, you quickly realize that the selection bias that goes into how the studies were designed essentially make it so that it's very hard to draw conclusions and extrapolate into a general population. So you see statistics.
Maybe boil it down for us, and I'll keep stabbing myself in the thigh with a fork to focus.
Okay, so in the studies, calcium and vitamin D increased bone mineral density, but did not consistently reduce the risk of fractures. The data is very inconsistent on this point.
It's strange that bone density wouldn't be a valid surrogate marker here, because logically, increasing your bone density should decrease your risk of a broken bone. I mean, I understand that surrogate markers are by their nature imperfect, which is why hard clinical endpoints like fractures are so important. But still, it seems strange that better bone density might not translate into fewer fractures.
Well, the problem is that many of the larger studies were done in the general population. Not everybody was vitamin D deficient, and not everybody had a confirmed diagnosis of osteoporosis. Maybe in a highly selected population, you would see a more consistent benefit. But in the general population, no. Still, these supplements are a mainstay of osteoporosis treatment, and given that they are relatively inexpensive, they will likely continue to be so for now.
Okay, calcium and vitamin D supplements, not clear that they prevent fractures due to osteoporosis, but hey, they're safe and relatively cheap. Let's move on to the more expensive drugs, or at least drugs that were once more expensive. Nowadays, they are all generic and they cost a fraction of what they once did. But still, let's talk about bisphosphonates. What do they do?
They inhibit osteoclasts, so they prevent bone resorption. And given that most postmenopausal osteoporosis is due to increased osteoclast activity and bone resorption, well, these drugs are very effective. They improve bone density and reduce fractures. That is pretty clear, and it's somewhat amazing to me that there are people who doubt their efficacy, given that you have multiple trials showing a consistent effect for multiple different drugs from the same drug class.
Okay, that was straightforward for a change. Any reason to prefer one bisphosphonate over another?
No, I mean, they're all pretty much the same. Some have become more popular with time, but there's no clear advantage to one over the other.
Now, there was some controversy with these medications, wasn't there? I mean, I remember something about these medications actually causing fractures or something along those fractured lines.
Well, okay, so two things. First, apart from the esophagus stuff.
I'm sorry, the esophagus stuff?
Right, so bisphosphonates can cause esophagitis. So they can irritate the esophagus, aka the food pipe, the thing that connects your mouth to your stomach. And there was a relative contraindication against giving them to anyone with a pre-existing esophageal problem. They would also recommend a very specific way to take the pills. You had to take them and drink water and stay upright for 30 to 60 minutes to minimize that risk. And some people, not many, but some, couldn't tolerate them easily.
But there were some weird, like atypical fractures in people taking these pills, weren't there?
Yeah, so two different stories that sort of got conflated. The first was osteonecrosis of the jaw, basically exposed necrotic bone in the face.
Necrotic meaning dead. That sounds horrible.
It's not great. I'm not going to lie to you. And now that was a very rare side effect, but it was mainly seen in people who took bisphosphonates intravenously for cancer.
For cancer?
Yeah, they would get high-dose intravenous therapy with bisphosphonates to prevent fractures from cancer metastases. It wasn't really an issue with people getting regular oral dosing for osteoporosis, but the risk was not zero, and it was something you needed to be aware of. So that's number one. But the other thing was atypical femoral fractures.
Just to remind people, the femur is the bone in your upper thigh. Essentially, it's your thigh bone, which connects to your hip bone.
Because the hip bone's connected to the thigh bone. The thigh bone's connected to the backbone. The backbone's connected to the shoulder bone. So hear the word of the Lord.
No singing. And no singing gospel music based on prophecies from the book of Ezekiel, despite their very, very tangential medical application.
You have very arbitrary rules. Anyway, yes, bisphosphonates were associated with atypical femoral fractures. So normally, fractures of the femur, hip fractures, occurred at the neck of the femur, where it joins to the pelvis in the hip socket. But some people who were taking bisphosphonates for many years would occasionally get fractures at other locations. So they were atypical in the sense that they were not classic osteoporotic fractures.
Any idea why this was happening?
Well, the prevailing theory is that long-term bisphosphonate use suppressed osteoclast activity, so less bone resorption, which is good, but also less bone turnover, which is bad. So the bone in the femur was essentially frozen bone and could suffer breaks after years of treatment. It was mostly an issue if you were taking the medication for more than 5 years.
Bone turnover, a great name for a band.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why people sometimes are told to only treat osteoporosis for 5 years and then stop?
Yes. Now, the decrease in typical fractures vastly outnumbered the increase in atypical fractures that you saw with long-term bisphosphonate therapy. But still, when you look at the data, after about 5 years, you weren't getting as much benefit anymore from continued treatment. So the recommendations were to treat people for 3 to 5 years if they were low risk and 10 years if they were high risk, and then possibly to stop. Because at that point, the risk-benefit trade-off started turning against you. And the benefits of the medication also did seem to persist for some time after the medication was stopped.
But what if you stopped the treatment and things got worse?
So that is a problem, to be sure. And at that point, you might want to consider restarting the medication after a 3 to 5 year holiday. Because these medications have long-lasting effects, that's probably the right interval. But that is based more on expert opinion than hard facts.
And bisphosphonates are the main treatment out there?
Yes, although more and more I see patients being prescribed denosumab, probably better known to most people as Prolia.
So given that its generic name ends in ab, that means it's an antibody.
Right. It inhibits osteoclasts. It's an injection that you take every 6 months. There's no gastrointestinal issues, which is good. You can give it to people with kidney problems because it's not cleared by the kidney. And some people really find it much more convenient than taking regular pills.
Any downsides?
Well, the fracture risk seems to go up when you stop it. The benefit doesn't persist long term like it seems to do with bisphosphonates. And the other downside is that it's really just much more expensive.
Seems like everything is about suppressing bone resorption. Isn't there anything that boosts bone production?
So there are medications that do that, but they aren't commonly used. They aren't the first-line therapies. I've seen them occasionally, but not very often, usually used as a backup therapy in cases of failure or intolerance.
So, I mean, there are a fair number of treatment options.
I mean, very much so. The important point is to have regular screening for osteoporosis so you can find the people to treat.
So regular screening for everyone?
Well, there is some debate. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends screening for women over 65 or over 50 if they have risk factors, things like smoking, a family history, or if they take steroids, stuff like that.
What about men?
So that is more debatable. The USPSTF gives that an inconclusive rating. Now, Some of the osteoporosis groups do recommend it, though. So it's a bit equivocal. I mean, if you have a particular reason to worry, or, you know, if your patient had a fracture and you wanted to rule out osteoporosis, that would be one thing. But a general screening strategy for all men is a little bit more uncertain.
And screening for bone mineral density should be done yearly?
No, a yearly is excessive. Every 2 years is the current recommendation for the high-risk patients. Lower-risk patients who have a normal bone density or just slightly below normal bone density can probably spread out those to longer intervals.
And you would reassess as risk factors change, presumably because as people get older, then the risk goes up.
Yes, and you know, because treating people prevents fractures. I mean, these medications have side effects and costs, yes, but they are better than breaking a hip.
So you don't need to wait until you've broken a hip.
There's screening and treatment at your fingertip.
You don't need to wait until you've broken a hip.
There's screening and treatment at your fingertip.
You don't need to wait until you've broken a hip. There's screening and treatment at your fingertips. You don't need to wait until you've broken a hip. There's screening and treatment at your fingertips. You don't need to wait until you've broken a hip. There's screening and treatment at your fingertips.
And remember, the leg bone's connected to the hip bone. The hip bone's connected to the backbone.
The back bone's
connected to the shoulder bone. So hear the word of the Lord.
You can stop singing now.
No.
Coming up next, we rarely use the word breakthrough, but it is important to recognize that sometimes new medical treatments really do make a significant difference. There's a new treatment for metastatic melanoma, and we discuss it after the break. Step into our audio-only time machine and revisit past episodes of the podcast. Here's a clip from our conversation with Matthew Remsky on conspirituality.
A public health crisis comes along. It meets this network of charismatic influencers who have been trying to sell the aspirational self as the root of all health. And what COVID-19 says is, nope, that's not true.
All of our episodes are available at bodyofevidence.ca and wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to the Body of Evidence. Stage 4 cancer, which is the metastatic stage, can often feel like a death sentence. But through research, certain medications have been shown to improve survival for patients dealing with end-stage cancer. We're going to talk about a phase 3 clinical trial pitting two treatments against each other for metastatic melanoma. But first off, what should people know about melanoma?
Metastatic melanoma is really, really bad. I mean, if you have a skin lesion and you can get it diagnosed early, the success rate is actually very high. Like a stage 1 melanoma, 5-year survival rate is like over 90%, if not over 95%, actually. It's extremely high because you basically go, you get it surgically excised, and it's gone. It's when it spreads that it becomes very, very difficult to treat. And, you know, with each stage, as you get into stage 4, the survival rate is very, very low. And if you look back at the way things were, you know, a couple of decades ago, it was essentially a death sentence. Things have gotten better now, thankfully. But metastatic melanoma, especially when it starts spreading to places like the brain, survival was frankly terrible. And so a treatment for that is obviously would be very, very welcome and lead to a lot of improved survival from patients who suffer with this.
From what I remember, it's a cancer that progresses very quickly. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the lesion drills down and gains access to your blood supply and becomes a metastatic quite quickly. So it is a type of skin cancer. It's not the most prevalent type of skin cancer,
but it's responsible for most of the deaths.
Right. And it's especially the people that really need to worry, especially are white people living in places where there's a lot of sunshine, because if you don't wear protection or if you go to a tanning salon on a regular basis, you're increasing your risk for skin cancer in general and for melanoma as well.
Big problem in Australia, where you have a very Caucasian population living in a very, very tropical climate with a lot of sun.
Indeed. So back in 2011, and shortly after I had started a PhD on, among many things, metastatic melanoma, a game-changing drug was approved for this condition. Its brand name is Yervoy, but its generic name is ipilimumab, or ipi for short. Ipi was an antibody. We're seeing a lot of those right now. Right? They can be quite potent, but they're also very expensive. And ipi was seen to activate the immune system in a specific way, leading to improved survival, especially when it is now combined with a different antibody that inhibits a specific molecule called PD-1. Can you speak a little bit to ipi's influence on the treatment of metastatic melanoma?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to understate how important this discovery was for really the burgeoning field of immunotherapy for cancer. It's not an accident that Professor Allison won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of this drug in 2018, I want to say. I think that's about right. So it opened up a whole new field, which we, broadly call immune therapy, meaning using immune molecules to treat cancer. So the other important thing to remember is that the survival rate for metastatic melanoma has increased substantially over the past few years. So if you were to go online and look up this stuff, you'll see five-year survival rates of maybe 20%, 30%. But a lot of that data is based on trials from before a lot of these checkpoint inhibitors and the newer drugs actually got approved. And so the five-year survival rate for cancer, I mean, a lot of experts will quote a number 50%. It's actually hard to see where that number comes from, but a lot of people in the field keep saying that. And so it definitely is higher than the 20 to 30% survival statistics you see if you were to go to sort of like, cancer.org in the US or some of these websites where you see a lot of these statistics. So there's definitely been an improvement, and it's largely laid at the feet of immunotherapy, specifically the checkpoint inhibitors, the PD-1 inhibitors that you mentioned, and ipilimumab, which is a CTLA-4. So basically, you're stopping the thing that inhibits your cytotoxic T lymphocytes from going off and killing the cancer, because your immune system is trying to kill cancer. It just sometimes can't do it because something blocks it. So a lot of these antibodies are about blocking the thing that is blocking your immune system and letting your immune system have at the tumors.
Yeah, so when you learn about molecular biology, there are lots of these cascades where in your body, this protein goes on to activate this protein, which goes on to inhibit that protein, which goes on to... And it's this huge cascade of events, and these drugs, these immunotherapeutic drugs, will often block one part of that cascade, and that has repercussions, and that's how you treat people. Now, we're not here to talk about ipilimumab, because that's old news. Mm-hmm. We now have the publication in the New England Journal of Medicine of the results from a phase 3 clinical trial done by a group of Dutch researchers. They compared ipi with a different type of therapy, also in the immune system space. So it's the use of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, or TILs, T-I-L. What are those?
So the name itself should give you the clue. They are lymphocytes. White blood cells that are within the tumor. So if you can imagine, you have... your skin cancer, which has spread. So there is a metastasis somewhere, and there are white blood cells within that tumor that tried to kill it and didn't quite make it work. So the idea is, if you can take these lymphocytes and then reactivate them in some way and get them to go and kill the tumor. So rather than giving somebody an antibody, which is inhibiting a protein that's allowing your immune system to get turned on, you're actually taking the white blood cells themselves and setting them loose against the cancer.
So what did the researchers do in the context of this trial, and what are they reporting?
Yeah, so the way you get this therapy to work, there's a multiple step thing. So first you have to have surgery. You have to have a metastatectomy. So you go and you surgically remove
it. I've never heard that word before.
Yeah,
so metastatectomy.
Statectomy.
Right.
Okay. So you surgically remove a metastasis to get the tumor and get the lymphocytes.
Right.
And then you dissolve away the tumor. You keep the lymphocytes. You put them in a broth to sort of allow them to multiply. So you make like multiple copies of them.
So the goal of the surgery is not... for the patient to just remove the metastasis. It's to gather the cells that you need for the treatment.
Exactly. So you get that. So once you do the surgery and you get the lymphocytes and you enrich them. So you multiply them many, many times. Then you give the patient immunosuppressive chemotherapy to suppress their immune system.
Right.
Then you re-inject them with the TILs and then also give them interferon therapy to activate the white blood cells so the white blood cells will become active.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question you should ask, how do the lymphocytes know to go and attack the cancer?
Right. Well, I'm guessing is that they have been trained to recognize the tumor, and so by recognizing surface antigens of the tumor.
Right, but not by the researchers. That's what's, I think, the most brilliant thing, is that because you took it from the metastasis,
right. it naturally recognizes the microenvironment
that they were in, they go back to that place. And this is why, I mean, a lot of stem cell therapies and a lot of these therapies have not worked, because if you just inject stem cells blindly into somebody, the stem cells don't know what you want them to do, right? They don't know they're supposed to go and fix the broken heart. They're just like floating around. Even if you inject them directly in the heart, they're like, you never told me to become a myocardial cell. Like, I don't know what you want me to do.
But these are white blood cells that were already trained in the body to recognize a cancer. They were just in an environment where there weren't enough of them. They couldn't multiply enough. Right. They couldn't just take care, but now you just enrich them and you put them back in the patient's body.
Exactly. And you give them the immunosuppressive chemotherapy beforehand to suppress their native immune system.
Which is probably where the negative side effects of this therapy come from.
Yeah, all the big side effects were largely because of the chemotherapy, which obviously is chemotherapy. Like, it's, you know, it's not a risk-free procedure, but that's part of the treatment.
So what were their results?
The results were pretty impressive. So to quote the statistics, first of all, I think it's important to point out what they did was they weren't testing this against placebo.
No.
They were testing this against IPI.
Right.
So already
Which
something...
Which is standard of care, I'm guessing, at this point.
Yeah, well, more and more. It's combo therapy now. It's combo therapy. So IPI in it isn't of itself... The PD-1 inhibitors, a different type of checkpoint inhibitor, those are sort of the first line, but it's been shown that when you combine those with IPI, you get a better response. So,
okay, so let me stop you right there. Why didn't they compare this against standard of care, which would have been ipilimumab plus a PD-1 or something of that nature? Why didn't they compare this against combo therapy?
So I can't answer that question. I think that when they had started the trial, I think the therapy hadn't evolved to that
point. Okay, that's a possibility. All right.
I think that's the most likely explanation.
Okay, interesting.
But but here's the thing. I mean, ultimately, they're going to see how do you combine this with other stuff. But I think it's interesting to see that they weren't comparing this against placebo. They were comparing it against something that is pretty effective, right? Mm-hmm. And even though IPI is not the first line therapy, it is still effective. It's just that you gain more benefit when you combine it with other stuff. So they compared it against that, and they saw, so the percentage of patients that had progression-free survival at 6 months.
Can you define progression-free survival?
So there had not been a worsening of the cancer, okay? So they were either the same or better. Okay, so the number of people who were the same or better at 6 months was 52.7% in the TIL group and 21.4% in the IPI group. So you went from about 20% to over 50%.
That's a huge change. If you look at the confidence intervals, it's still clearly different.
Yeah, and what's even, I think, even more interesting, if you look at the patients who had an objective response, so there's a few different ways to sort of measure this stuff and there are firm criteria, but if you look at the patients who got better, who had an objective response, so the tumor shrank, it was 49% in the TIL group and 21% in the IPI group. So, you know, twice as good. And if you look at people who had complete responses, meaning the tumors disappeared, 20% in the TIL group, 7% in the IPI group. And that's impressive. I mean, to have a complete response from metastatic melanoma, I mean, you know, 20% is not that high, but I'm like, I was pretty impressed.
I'll take it.
You know, if you can essentially cure 1 in 5 people with metastatic melanoma with this therapy, that's impressive. That's very impressive.
Okay, so a philosophical question. When I was working on melanoma, a good chunk of the research being done in the research center where I was geared toward finding new treatments for metastatic cancer. So end-stage cancer, your cancer has spread to other parts of your body, to distant parts of your body. And one of my colleagues at the time made the point that he thought that it was, in a sense, an inefficient way to spend research funds. Shouldn't we spend this money on trying to prevent cancer from arising in the first place, either through public awareness campaigns for well-known preventative measures or through researching ways to more accurately detect cancer, especially when the tumor is really small and could easily be treated. What do you make of this argument? I mean, obviously, you're going to say, well, we should be funding both, but we have limited resources. What do you say about, you know, investing money into researching how to treat end-stage cancer?
So here's the thing. If you don't invest the money in basic, I'm trying to say primary research. That's not the right term. What am I thinking of?
Basic research?
Well,
fundamental research?
Yeah, fundamental research. Anyways, I'm blanking on the term I actually want
to use. So what do you mean, like something that does not have obvious clinical applications,
exactly,
just understanding human biology, for
exactly.
example?
Because here's the thing. If you gave a basic science researcher $500,000, that's a significant grant, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to do any significant public health campaign with $500,000. You're not going to accomplish all that much.
Mm-hmm.
You are absolutely right in the sense that you're going to save more people with prevention than you will with treatment, right? An ounce of prevention is always worth a pound of cure. That is always true. And this, and we talked about this at the beginning, the survival rate with melanoma, much, much higher if you get it early. So if you wanted to have a derm screening program, that would obviously help, and we should definitely do that.
Or banning tanning booths.
Banning tanning booths, which, you know, there has been progression on that. So here's the thing. That's absolutely something that we should do. But we're never going to discover new things unless we fund it. And you don't know how some of these immune therapies are going to be used or applicable in other types of cancer. So yes, you can make that argument for skin cancer. But now that you have a proof of concept, you can start using immune therapy in other types of cancers. We'll see what the future holds. But you're never going to know that unless you actually fund that research, because you don't know where research is going to take you. New discoveries, you know, somebody was working on these very obscure types of lymphocytes, and it turned into a Nobel Prize, and you develop IPI, which was a significant improvement in treating patients who have metastatic melanoma. So I get the point, and you're absolutely right, but I still think it's important to fund basic research.
It wasn't the point that I was making.
My former colleague was making. But
there was some validity to it.
There's some validity to it.
It was worth discussing.
Yeah, it's an investment. You're not spending the money to necessarily get a return, to get something back from it. You're investing it in the long term, because overall, when you do that, you advance science and you make new discoveries that end up being useful for sometimes things that were unrelated to what you were planning.
Good point. When we come back, it's gotten really cold here in Montreal, and many people, especially elderly individuals who can't afford it, will be flying south if they haven't already. They will be seeking travel insurance for their health in case something happens, and Chris wants to remind them that there are important caveats here that they may not be aware of. That's after the break.
Do you like medicine that tastes funny and science made easy? Jonathan and I are so much more than disembodied voices on the internet. Join our Facebook community, follow us on Instagram, and check out our website at bodyofevidence.ca to find all of our episodes as well as our science cartoons. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Labos, and Jonathan is at Cracked Science. Let's fight back against misinformation.
Welcome to the final stretch of the Body of Evidence. If you're traveling to another country, you may want to get health insurance in case something happens while you're abroad. But many people don't know that there is some, shall we say, interesting fine print in health insurance documents.
Yes. Traveling is bad, and you should fear the unknown.
Okay. And not because of COVID.
Not because of COVID. Just, you know, anything can happen. No, so here's the thing. I mean, a lot of people travel down south and a lot of people take extended trips. So there's a few things that you should know. A lot of people, myself included, almost never really think about travel insurance because on my credit card, if I book a trip with my credit card, I'm like, oh, I have travel insurance, and that's great. Except there are often limits. So my credit card limits my travel insurance to 3 weeks. So any trip that is more than 3 weeks, I'm not covered at the end of 21 days. So when you travel, make sure if you have some sort of automated travel insurance as part of your credit card that you actually look into it and say, what does it actually cover.
Right.
Because a lot of them will cover flight cancellation insurance, but may not necessarily cover you if you get sick. So there's a lot of fine print. But the big one is duration. So if you're planning an extended trip somewhere, especially, and if you're going to multiple different places, sometimes your, you know, off-the-rack travel insurance that you got with your credit card may not actually cover you. But more relevantly to people who have medical diseases, what you should realize is that most travel insurance companies, especially the big ones, will not cover you if you've had or if you have an active medical problem. And they usually define that in such a way. You went to a doctor, got a test, have pending tests, or had a change in your medication in the past 3 months.
And would that mean that you get no coverage whatsoever,
yeah,
or that you're not covered if there is a development that involves a specific disease?
Depends on the policy. Depends on the policy. Some, if you saw your cardiologist and you went and you like fell and broke your ankle, again, it depends on your insurance company.
You know, okay.
I mean, you have to, there's often a lot of negotiating that has to go in with it. Because don't forget, insurance companies don't make money by writing you checks, right?
No.
So
they want to take in as much money as possible and give out as little as they can.
Right, because that's how their business model works. But so in your policy, these exclusions do exist. And whether it's only related to your specific problem or not depends on how your policy is written. So you need to look into it, because it's not rare that I've had people come to see me for whatever reason. I order tests, usually like stress tests or cardiac ultrasounds. It takes, unfortunately, now in many places, 6 months or more to get tests done.
Oof.
People are like, oh, well, I'll get it when I come back from Florida because I'm going for Florida 6 months. So they travel there. And I always tell them, I say, listen, be careful. If something happens and your insurance company requests your medical records, and they'll be like, oh, you had a test pending. Why did you travel if you had a test pending? And this happened to a patient who was in Europe and was waiting for a test and said, ah, to heck with this, I'll go get it done in Europe, not realizing his insurance company now is doing an issue, saying like, well, we don't want to pay for it. Like,
right,
your doctor ordered a test. Why did you travel? And, you know, again, medical tourism is obviously a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, it probably would have been cheaper to get it done in Europe than it would here. But, you know, here it was free.
Mm-hmm.
And in Europe, the insurance company has to pay for it. So there's these things. And it's a particular issue when you have to do very sort of benign dose adjustment stuff. Like, okay, I'm going to raise your cholesterol level. People are like, is this going to affect my travel insurance? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. It really depends. Like, to me, increasing somebody's blood pressure medication doesn't count as instability. You're just fine-tuning their medical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the way in which some of these policies are written are like any new or change to medication counts. So then you often have to speak to an agent and fight with them. And it's, again, not rare that I've had to write letters to insurance companies saying like, look, this is a pretty minor thing. You should still cover the person for what happened to them in the US.
Yeah, I was not aware of that. And I mean, even myself, when I traveled to the UK recently and I had taken travel insurance, some of my medication for an unrelated thing had changed, and had something happened that might have caused an issue, and I had no idea.
Yeah. Now, again, you can always make the argument, because let's say your first claim is refused. You can always resubmit. And in most cases, because again, most of the people working at an insurance company are not evil villains, right? They'll be like, yeah, okay, so you got a different asthma medication and, you know, you suffered food poisoning. Okay, those probably were not related, I guess. So again, these, you do deal with people and you can always appeal, but you have to be aware that there are issues with automatic refusals. And, you know, trying to recoup the costs of medical care somewhere else is not necessarily cheap. The big thing, of course, during the pandemic was a lot of these companies also had COVID exclusions. I mean, like,
right,
if you go and you catch COVID, well, we'll cover everything, but not COVID, because
right,
we can't control that. COVID is an act of God, you know?
Right. We're still using that terminology.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and this is very common in the insurance thing. Like, you know, well,
this
is going to be a little bit specific for our international listeners, but we had like a big natural disaster in the Atlantic provinces, right? Where, you know, the storms that destroyed a lot of properties.
Yeah. Acts of God.
Yeah. Because your insurance will not cover that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is specifically written, like if there's an earthquake or a flood, your home insurance will not cover that. You are actually dependent on federal emergency relief funding.
I think that some insurance companies will, you can buy like extra
supplemental coverage.
Exactly, for earthquakes and things of that nature.
Yeah, depending on where, depending on what. Right. But a lot of the insurance companies will, to protect themselves, do not cover large disasters because that would bankrupt them, right?
Right.
If you own all the if you own all the home insurance policies in an area and there's a fire and it destroys everything, you're like, you're bankrupt. You can't play out. I mean, the insurance industry works on the principle that not everybody is going to suffer an accident at the same time. Yeah. So be careful when you buy insurance. Read the fine print, ask questions, speak to an agent, and realize that sometimes you have to buy supplemental travel insurance to go on top of what you would like normally have, especially for longer trips or if things have changed. And always ask first, because if you lie and you don't disclose stuff, they use that.
Right.
So you always ask them, like, if I do this, is this going to invalidate it? And you know what? In many circumstances, maybe no, but you have to be aware that this problem exists.
Well, I was not aware that this problem exists, so thank you very much for bringing this to my and to our listeners' attention. Before we thank our patrons, we are starting a new segment here at the end of every regular episode. Our most famous talk show host here in Quebec, Guy Lepage, has been referring to Twitter as the Twitanic, as it slowly sinks in the ice-cold alt-right waters. Chris and I are still on Twitter for now. I have joined Post News, by the way.
You're going to have to explain to me what that is.
I'll explain to you afterwards.
Is it like Twitter, but different?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good. I'm looking forward to Facebook and Twitter collapsing, because then I'm not going to learn any more new social media things.
We'll get you on Twitch and on Hive and on a bunch of
I opened a Mastodon account and I haven't used it for anything.
Yeah, I'm not going there. But anyway, we are starting a segment on the show called It's Not Twitter, But It'll Do, where we will quickly mention the kinds of things that we typically tweet out. That means some interesting media appearances involving us. It means articles that we wrote that we want to draw people's attention to. And it also means alerting our listeners to things that we've read or seen or heard that have to do with health and medicine or critical thinking more broadly, and that we think that that you would enjoy. So I'm going to start with my guest spot on the Marshall Culture podcast. So a year ago, we had Coach Rene Dreyfus on our show to talk about evidence-based martial arts. I was on his show.
Basically punch the other guy. That's evidence-based martial arts.
Yeah, or throw sand in their eye. Yeah. That's your go-to technique.
Or bring a gun.
Or bring a gun to to a fist show. But anyway, I was on Rene Dreyfus's show recently. It's called the Marshall Culture Podcast, where I talked about pseudoscience, and we drew examples from both health and the martial arts. So if that is something that you think you might be into, look up the Marshall Culture Podcast. The episode came out December 19th. I also wrote about a device that is being endorsed by a lot of women on Instagram. It's called the Healy, and it's supposed to use frequencies to help the body heal itself from practically everything. But I also explained how pseudoscientific gadgets get away with making claims that seem to be direct health claims. So you can learn a little bit about the regulatory environment that allows devices like the Healy to survive and thrive. And something that has nothing to do with me and nothing to do with medicine, but I wanted to plug, is a New York Times podcast, Hard Fork. It's about technology. It's about the internet. If you were a fan of the show Reply All before it imploded, and you're looking for that kind of approach to talk about what's trending on the internet and that kind of back and forth between the hosts, I highly recommend Hard Fork. They've done a number of episodes on Twitter, and they did an in-depth one on that new artificial intelligence ChatGPT. Really well explained, fun to listen to. All those links to the things that I mentioned will be in the show notes. Chris, what about you?
I like long walks in the rain.
What's the name of that app where you meet women?
You mean Tinder?
Yes. It's not Tinder.
It's Twinder.
It's called It's Not Twitter, but it'll do.
Yeah, it's Twinder. So listen, people who want to see me, I'm usually on a number of different networks. What's interesting, and I haven't quite figured this out yet, a lot of the times I can't repost the stuff because they don't necessarily make the full clips available. CTV does, CBC not so much.
Oh, that's interesting.
I kind of have to wait and then wait to see if the Google alert on my name will pick it up or not. So for people who want to know where they can see me, Monday mornings, I do CBC Morning Live. So that's CBC or CBC Gem if you want to watch internationally. So that's Monday mornings at usually around 7:40. There's usually a bit of give
Lucky
or take.
Lucky you.
Yeah. Well, I've done earlier, trust me. So that's 7:40. CTV, Montreal, I do my regular interview at around 12:30, 12:40, which then gets rebroadcast.
That's on Wednesdays.
On Wednesdays. That gets rebroadcast on the evening news. I do a regular segment with CJAD, and that is available on CJAD, their website. It's part of the iHeartRadio network. So that is every Sunday morning. I also do a Greek language TV show on the network called Odyssey TV, which is a Canadian Greek language network. So you can listen to me do the same stuff I normally do, but in Greek, if you're so inclined. And so that's my regular stuff. The only different thing that I did recently, there was an article on CBC about looking like a retrospective on the mpox outbreak and like why did that go so well,
formerly known as monkeypox,
which they shortened to mpox, which I don't think is going to accomplish what they meant to accomplish, because
everybody will be explaining no, it's monkeypox.
Yeah, I mean,
for a while at least.
If you're gonna rename it, then rename it, because everybody asks, what does the M stand for? Well, it used to be for monkeys, and right. Anyways, so I'm not sure that renaming strategy was the most effective thing possible, but...
Chrispox.
Yeah. Well, just call it something else. Like, just give,
like
it, give it a new name.
Like
I don't
know. Make one up.
I don't know. Could call it, Steve. I don't know. Well, but here's the thing.
I got a bad case of the Steves.
Well, here's the thing. Even the word pox is a misnomer because it's an archaic term that could mean a bunch of different stuff, right? If you're like, oh, does it mean it's close to chicken pox? No.
No, right. Yeah.
So just call it like, you know, I mean, COVID-19.
Virus C1338.
No, but not even that. Just call it, you know, I'm trying to remember what family class the virus comes from, and I'm completely blocking now. It's an is it an orthopox virus? I can't remember now, but
let's say that it is an orthopoxy virus.
Yeah, so just call it, you know, orthovirus. Like that,
that's a virus. That's not the disease.
Well, just call the disease the same as the virus. It doesn't matter. I don't know. I feel like if you're going to rename
medicine,
it,
medicine would be so boring if you were to name everything in it.
Yeah, I guess so. But
I like physicists. Like they're like, what is that? That's a top quark.
That's a top quark.
And that's a charm quark. Mm. Why? Because.
Because. Or, you know, biochemists who name stuff. Like, this is the Sonic the Hedgehog
gene. Yes, Sonic the Hedgehog. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why? Because I like Sonic the Hedgehog. Anyway, so a retrospective on the mpox outbreak. I guess the pandemic is technically not over because there's still a lot of cases going on around the world. But, you know, why did that work? And what were the strategies that were useful? So I thought that was an interesting interview to give. And, you know, spent more than I normally would with the journalists because usually like, you know, three quotes and then done. This thing actually wanted to know, like, what does it mean that there's an animal reservoir, you know? So differentiating that from smallpox and why smallpox was able to be eradicated. And mpox...
Eradicated or eliminated? I always confuse those two.
No, eradicated means there's no cases anywhere, whereas eliminated means... Hold on.
I think it's the opposite.
I'm going to look it up now.
You would think that eradicated means it's gone from the world, but I don't think so.
Eliminated or eradicated.
This is why
eradication means that a disease is completely reduced to zero worldwide, whereas elimination means the disease has been reduced to zero in a specific region.
Oh, okay. All right.
So we've eliminated... polio,
yes,
but in Canada.
But we have eradicated smallpox.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. At least it makes sense. Eradicate should mean there's none left.
Yeah. So, yeah, so you can check that out on cbc.ca if you're interested in going to look.
All right. We want to thank a patron who upped their pledge, Dee Herzog, and we want to thank our newest patron, Janet Robinson. We want to thank Ian for his regular PayPal contribution. We want to thank all of our patrons, but especially those at the $5 or more level, and they are... Alan, Barb, Bill, Brian, D, Dan, DJA, Don, Al, Frank, Jeff, Grace, Isabel, Islan, Janikala, Jeff, Joanne, John, Juan, Caitlin, Carrie, Ken, Leanne, Leon, Leslie, Louise, Luna, Lindsay, Marianne, Mark, Mary, Mavis, Miriam, Misby, Nolan, Olga, Pascal, Pat, Paul, Rina, Robin, Ronald, Rye, Scott, That Montreal Guy, and Trimian.
Oh, yes. Now, a small technical note. We've gotten a few messages from people recently asking, could we refer to them as this or that on Patreon?
As Steve, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the thing. There is some functionality to Patreon. So if you want your name to appear a certain way, you can actually change it on Patreon. And you can make it a joke. Like, you can make it anything, you know? And if you ever need to communicate with us directly, when you communicate with us, you can just say, by the way, my real name is Bill, or, you know,
Steve
or whatever. So
M-Pox.
Yeah, if you want to change your name, you can change it whatever you want. Even if you don't want your name read, you can just put it as anonymous or anonymous or, you know, some variation. So there is the creativity there to have some fun with it. And people do sometimes like to use joke names, like, you know, top card in the deck or something. You can put whatever you want. So if you do want to change your name, do that. If you're not that comfortable with it and you want to, like, message us directly, you can totally do that. But if you want to make sure that your name is always going to appear the way you want it to, just go change your username on Patreon. That's the easiest, least labor intensive way to go about it, because there's always the potential that we'll forget to update the list from month to month. So anyways, just a quick note, because we got a few different messages on that, so we're just letting people know that you do have that option on Patreon to pick whatever name you want.
And in the interest of disclosure, I think it's worth going over where the money goes, you know, once in a while, and where we would like it to go. So since September, and for the first time in 7+ years, Chris and I now take half of our very modest profits monthly as compensation.
This is the first I hear about this.
Shoot. I was hoping to keep it a secret. The other half is put aside for an upcoming ad campaign where we hope to draw in more listeners. And eventually, as we hinted at the beginning of the show, we would love to finance a pilot episode for a TV show or web or streaming show of some sort. We have some interesting ideas. We will need more money than we have now, but that is the ultimate goal here.
I thought the ultimate goal was world domination.
World eradication is the ultimate goal for MPOX. If you want to help support our show, go to bodyofevidence.ca/about and you will see two options. You can make a donation through PayPal, or you can become a patron on Patreon, either making monthly contributions or an annual contribution. When you become a patron, for as little as $1 a month, you get access to a patron-only bonus segment each month called Digressions. And this month's Digressions will be on...
We're going to be answering some of our your questions on osteoporosis. So you asked and we answer.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our jingle was composed and performed by Joseph Hackle. You can find his music at josephhackle.bandcamp.com. Check the show notes for full music credits. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy. Proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at the body of evidence.